Oye, oye, oye. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3062, et al. United States of America versus Charles E. Coughlin, appellant. Mr. Klepper for the appellant, Ms. Winchester for the appellee.
May it please the court.
Morning.
Good morning. In this case, we have a theory of the case jury instruction that renders the analysis rather easy and transparent. And also, the government, like any litigant, must live with the consequences of its strategic decisions. And no prosecutor is going to conduct a six-week trial for a case that's worth approximately $2,000 to $12,000. And that is why the government strategically did not submit this narrower scheme alternate theory to the jury for its consideration. Which leads us to a question, which is, why is it that it makes sense to restrict the government to those theories that it submitted to the jury for its active consideration?
Can I ask you about that?
Yes.
I have sort of a very long question.
Yes.
I'm going to go sort of go through the, since the Supreme Court has told us we need to go through the record and the arguments and the jury instructions, that's sort of really what I'd like to do. And just on exactly the issue you raised. I'm going to present it in a way that seems most towards the government's theory with respect to counts 6 and 7. Leave aside mail counts. On a theory that Coughlin, with respect to the May hearing, presented a new theory, that is for economic damages, which he had not presented before. But that included fraud, which was not presented before. And the government told the jury that they could find, and the court told the jury that they could find, with respect to the extent of the fraud, he didn't have to have the full extent of the fraud. I guess I want to know why that approach with respect to counts 6 and 7 doesn't work. So let's go through the record.
Yes.
For a second, okay? So at the actual May 13th hearing, Mr. Coughlin's lawyer, Lake, is it pronounced?
Yeah, Lake.
Yeah, Lake says, I'm reading from RE 2691. In trying to document future economic loss, one of the things we did not spell out in the initial claim, so now we're talking about the May hearing, he says we did not make this claim originally, was the fact that there was past, present, and future loss of earnings component to this claim, which was never even made initially. So that element of the fraud, his lawyer at the hearing is saying, we did not make that presentation before, right? And that runs all the way, the May hearing is after the mailings, correct?
Yes, Judge Garland,
yes.
If I may,
yes.
What Mr. Lake is referring to is,
yeah,
that when Commander Coughlin submitted his December 22nd facsimile,
yeah,
that did not include an economic damage component.
Well, so did the January 22nd, 2004 letter, which is RE 2640, says there is no claim for loss of income or loss of past or present earnings in this case.
Well, that is about the earnings. The,
yeah,
issue, the central issue we're talking about are the checks.
Well, the central issue I'm talking about is whether there's any fraud in May that wasn't present before. That's what I'm asking you about. And it seems like he's making a direct statement in January that nothing is material with respect to income for past or present earnings. Is he not saying that? And he says, all we want is $180,000. That's the sum I recommend to you.
Judge Garland, if I may.
Yeah.
Every statement in this, reviewing the entire record, needs to be viewed in the larger picture. And what Your Honor is pointing toward is that if the government had wished, perhaps, theoretically, it could have constructed a case that would have permitted such a conclusion that there was a new fraud relating to the lost wages.
So what you fall back to, I don't mean in any pejorative sense, is not that they couldn't have made this argument in terms of the evidence actually presented at the trial, but that that's not their theory. Is that right?
I'd like to qualify that slightly, which is that I think there would have needed to be some added dimension to the evidence at trial. Because as this court has said, sinners can become saints and saints become sinners.
Not sure what that means, but sounds good.
And if you look at, in particular, the Fifth Circuit cases.
No, I don't want to look at the Fifth Circuit
okay.
cases. The only case that mattered to me is the Supreme Court's opinion in Yeager. Okay, and the Supreme Court's citing of Ash and like that. Okay.
Well, what the Supreme Court says is,
with due respect to the other circuits.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind the Fifth Circuit's case.
With respect to the Yeager reaffirms that Ash in full. And also what it reaffirms is that there are central constitutional public policy issues inherent in this doctrine, and that the Supreme Court does not want this doctrine to be an exceptional circumstances.
No, I'm with you on that. What I'm asking is, there's evidence in the record of a different kind of yes. fraud, right, with respect to May.
Your Honor, actually, the real issue is that there needs to be some kind of evidence from which a jury can infer that there was a change in intent. A switch was flipped from good faith to bad faith between April 30th and May
13th. Not from good faith to bad faith, but to a different fraudulent scheme. I don't understand why it has to. You can have bad faith about one scheme and be liable for that scheme, and you can have bad faith for an increased scheme. And if you have an increased scheme, then you have a different crime. And here we're talking about mail fraud, which talks about a scheme, and I'm with you just for the purposes of this argument, we'll assume that there was a single scheme for the mail fraud. But let me just go on with why I think where the evidence is, and you can answer me. Now, so I take your point that the government has to make an argument in this respect.
Yes.
All right. So now we start with the government's opening statement, page 96, in which the government says, so defendant Charles Coughlin schemed to increase the amount of his award. At the hearing on May 13th, he submitted receipts and copies of check carbons that he claimed represent payments to others. So here the government is expressly telling you and the jury in its opening that there was a scheme to increase the amount of the award by May 13th.
Yes, Judge Garland, but there is one indictment here. And this is one indictment that charges a singular scheme. And their scheme does not become
formalized. You didn't challenge the indictment. The question is, what did the government argue? And what did the judge tell the jury was necessary?
Well, Your Honor.
It certainly isn't the case, is it, ordinarily, that the jury has to find everything in the entire scheme in order to find the crime.
No, Your Honor, but the government's case needs to be structured in such a way to admit of that alternate
theory.
All right,
that's what I'm trying to ask you about.
And, Your Honor, if I may, look at the rebuttal argument.
I'm going to get to it. Okay. I'm trying to do this chronologically.
All right.
Okay? So we start out with their opening argument. Right. Then we get to the government's closing argument, in which they say lost wages were a material part, now he's talking about the May hearing, were a material part of his claim for one simple reason. And that is, he told the VCF that he wanted to be compensated, which he had not done before. Then they talk about the spreadsheet, which was presented at the hearing. And he says, you know that's not true. That he said he took off time for certain things, that he didn't, that he claimed that his earnings were $150,000. That was material because he was claiming all the time he'd have to take off work he wanted to be compensated for at that hourly rate. So the government is presenting a theory in the closing argument that there was particular kinds of fraud presented at the May hearing, fraud that was not presented earlier.
Your Honor, the government says that, incorrectly, that Commander Coughlin tried to keep valuation evidence away from the jury because to prove count 7 theft, the government needs to prove, if it's anything less than 100% percent of the award.
Well, I don't see where that comes from. The judge's instruction says they have to prove more than $1,000. The jury's instruction doesn't say that on count seven theft, you have to prove the whole amount.
Well, if the government had raised this alternate theory, there would have been an instruction that would have guided the theory in that regard.
Why? Because this is not a civil case where the amount actually matters.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Why is that?
For the theft count,
yes.
Theft is not proved unless it's complete.
Really? So imagine that there were no other counts in this case at all, none, just the theft count.
Yes.
And it turns out that he's entitled to $180,000, but he's not entitled to another $220,000 on top of that. He didn't steal the additional $220,000.
No, the government needs to prove that the $220,000 was stolen.
Can't the government prove $1,000 more, $2,000, any amount of that amount?
Well, Your Honor, Commander Coughlin moved in limine to exclude the VCF hearing officer from testifying. He said that valuation testimony could come in, just not through the hearing officer because that was unfairly prejudicial. Judge Kennedy granted that. What the government then did was, whenever Commander Coughlin tried to introduce the documentation to prove that any portion of that $330,000 might be allocated to any particular piece of damage, the government moved to keep that out.
I'm not following. The government obviously put in evidence that some of the checks were fraudulent, right? Were not true, right?
Yes.
And the government put in evidence, and by cross-examination, that his salary was not $150,000, right? Coughlin was perfectly permitted to counter both of those, to prove that his salary was actually $150,000, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The problem is that without any valuation evidence in, there is no way to prove that the VCF, even one dime of what it awarded, was attributable to that. The VCF, in the black box as it was presented to the jury, its decision-making, it could have simply said, you know what, we don't buy his lost wages claim. We don't think he lost wages driving to these appointments, and they could have done that. There was no evidence that...
Well, that sounds like more like a sufficiency of the evidence argument than it sounds like a double jeopardy argument.
Well, actually, that is a sufficiency of the evidence argument, because even under the government's theory, the evidence presented at trial needed to have been sufficient to sustain count seven on a narrower scheme theory. There was no sufficiency...
You're not making a sufficiency argument on this appeal, and we wouldn't hear it because this is interlocutory.
No, Your Honor, this is a double jeopardy appeal, which depends on, even under the government's theory, what the record could have supported.
The only question was whether or not there was anything the jury necessarily decided in the acquitted counts that might bar trial on the post-April 30th activity. Isn't that the question?
Well, yes,
and
Your
therefore,
Honor.
What do we care? Why do we care what the jury might have thought about the post April 30 activity? What it decided with respect to the acquitted counts couldn't possibly affect that.
Well, Your Honor, and that's exactly right. If we are allowed
that
to introduce
help,
in the
that
evidence,
doesn't help your case, though.
Yes, it does, Your Honor. Anything that sua sponte, the jury could have concluded, is not part of the Ashyager analysis. And so if the jury, based on something the prosecution never argued, formed the basis for their acquittal, that's irrelevant. What we look at is...
When you say they ever argued, look at the government's closing. Now we're getting to the government's closing argument at 2402, specifically with respect to the sixth count, the false claims. You don't have to believe that the entire claim was false. All the government has to prove, and all our burden is to prove, is that a claim was false either entirely or in part. So even if you found only part of it was false, he still would be guilty to the offense if part of it is in a material way false. And that it fits exactly with what happens next, which is the judge's jury instructions, which say, at page 2540, a claim is false or fictitious if any part of it is untrue. A claim is fraudulent if any part of it is known to be untrue.
Your Honor,
I don't understand when you say that the government didn't present that theory.
To present the elements of the crime is not to adduce a specific factual theory for the jury's consideration. And what the government then did when it applied that general amount to the facts of this case, what they said in rebuttal was on page 2501, the government stressed this case is about whether he lied to the VCF about the nature and extent of his injuries, his physical limitations, and whether he deceived the VCF to try to get $331,000 that he didn't deserve.
But this is rebuttal. This is sort of summarizing the whole point. They laid out pretty clearly in the closing what their theory, and they in examination they argue that he decided in May to try to increase the amount of money by submitting false statements about the amount of money that I'm sorry, Judge Tatel.
I'm not sure why it makes any difference. You cite cases in your brief for the proposition in support of your proposition that the government can't pursue this theory because it didn't present it during the trial, right?
Yes.
That's your whole point. But as I read those cases, though, those are cases where the government not only didn't present the theory, but that there wasn't any evidence to support it. Here we have, as this colloquy you've just had with Judge Garland indicates, there is evidence to support the theory.
Am I
misreading those cases?
No, you are not. Uh-huh. But the fact is,
if I'm not, what difference does any of this make?
Because if the government is not restricted to the theories it actually presents, it never presented the evidence that could have supported count 7 on less than an all-or-nothing theory. It kept that evidence out.
How about count 6?
Count 6 was presented. That does not require proof of the completed fraud. But what that does demonstrate is that the counts 1 through 7 were presented as a single package, all up or all down theory. And that was the
If the jury had found that there was an exaggerated claim, in other words, as Judge Garland hypothesized, if there were $180,000 worth of legitimate and then the rest was illegitimate, wouldn't the jury have convicted on the acquitted counts?
It would have, well, I think, Judge Kavanaugh, I'm not quite sure whether we are allowed to make that argument as that gets into the supposing why the jury did not.
Acquitted counts.
On the acquitted counts.
Not the hung counts.
Would the jury have convicted? I believe it would have, because what we need to look at is.
I thought the mail fraud scheme, the defendant would have been found guilty if there were any fraud at all, whether it's the whole enchilada or it's just a partial fraud.
If you look at the May 13th hearing, Judge Kavanaugh, those checks were almost entirely checks except for $1,800 worth that had been listed in the January 22nd.
On my question, on the mail fraud, did you understand the mail fraud instructions to preclude the jury from finding guilt if it found that there was a partial fraud, in other words, an exaggeration?
Yes, absolutely. And I don't think that there is a serious defense of the mail fraud counts here, because if there was, chronologically speaking, a fraud from the beginning, at any time before April 30th, to exaggerate the claim, what would have happened was all of the count 2, 3, and 5 mailings all necessarily would have served to further both the legitimate and illegitimate aspects of the claim.
Well, part of our problem here is it seems clear the jury misunderstood the in furtherance of requirement. I realize we can't pay attention to that, but that seems what happened. And, you know, we are where we are on that.
Well, Your Honor, if I may point out, there is one case that has come down since briefing was completed. And while it's unpublished, it's the Fifth Circuit on remand from Yeager.
Yeah, I looked at that.
Right.
And the Fifth Circuit has reaffirmed that after the conference where Yeager allegedly participated in giving out false information, that necessarily precluded all of the insider trading counts because there was no evidence that there had been a flip of the switch afterwards he learned of the falsity. And the government there did not contend that theory had been there at trial, nor did they contend on appeal. The difference between that case and this one, and I do not want this oral argument to pass without pointing out, this case can rest simply on the grounds of appellate waiver, because the government did not present this narrower scheme theory to the district court in opposition to our motion.
Well, but the case you rely on has an interest of justice exception to it.
There is the manifest injustice.
Yeah.
However, and Judge Tatel.
Why isn't this a pretty good case for it? I mean, Yeager, as you point out in your brief, there was very limited time to brief this, and it's hard to see any prejudice. You've written a really thorough, terrific reply brief, so it's a little hard to see what the prejudice is.
There are 2 points, Your Honor.
Yeah.
The first is this: if this were a theory that on the record the parties thought was before the court, it didn't into the mind of the trial counsel or the district judge.
But then I re-ask my earlier question, which is, if I'm right about reading those cases, it doesn't make any difference whether or not this theory was presented at the trial.
I wholly disagree with that, Your Honor.
I thought you said you agreed with my reading.
I must have misunderstood the question.
what I said was, as I read those cases, they were all cases where the theory was, A, not presented, and B, there wasn't any evidence to support it.
I withdraw any such concession, Your Honor.
Okay.
And any others.
Exactly. There are no concessions here.
Okay.
I would point to there's Sealfon that had a narrower scheme theory attempted on the second retrial.
Yes, but that case, there was no evidence.
There wasn't any evidence to support it. That's my point.
And in fact, the instruction in that case had been that you've got a, that's the one with Greenwald, right? You had to find the connection to that guy. He was the only person that you could have conspired with.
Here's what I would say, Your Honor. For instance, look at Johnson versus Estelle and also Yeager on remand. And Fifth Circuit, not exactly known for being criminal defendant friendly. In Johnson versus Estelle, the prosecution theorized
a little too much of a broad brush, but anyway, go ahead.
In Johnson versus Estelle, the question was whether there was criminal intent, whether he could have, after breaking, been consumed with the urge to commit rape. And what that involved was the alleged flip of a switch in terms of intent. Now, intent is only something that can be proved by circumstantial evidence in general. There's rarely a smoking gun. But criminal intent is fundamentally different, and you at least need to provide that groundwork to the jury.
That's why I started the way I did, which was a letter from your client's lawyer saying, before we're not interested in economic damages, and now we are, and evidence that there's a different kind of fraud in May than there was before. That's the flip of the switch. And if I'm remembering Steel Fund correctly, in that case...
That did involve a single letter. I would...
It's not just a single letter. I may have got the cases mixed up, but I think it's the one where... let's see. Right. This has to do with Greenberg, where the... the petitioner was the only one on trial in the original conspiracy. There was no evidence to connect him with anyone other than Greenberg. Only if there was an agreement with at least Greenberg could the jury have convicted him. And in fact, the jury was told that the petitioner must be acquitted if there was reasonable doubt that he conspired with Greenberg. We don't have any of that. That's the narrower, the potentially narrow conspiracy, but it was the only conspiracy.
Well, there
and
is
we don't have that claim here.
Conspiracy presented here, Your Honor.
Well, nobody said in that case that you can convict even if you don't find Greenberg, but you find somebody else. And here, the jury is told by the judge and by the government that you can convict even if you don't find part of it fraudulent, as long as you find another part of it fraudulent. That seems pretty strongly different, at least from Sealfund.
There is the theory of the case instruction, which was good faith running the whole way through. Your Honor, it wasn't worthwhile for the government to hedge its bets. If we are really only talking about the lost wages, that is an infinitesimal percentage.
Just like you shouldn't make any inferences about the general views of the Fifth Circuit, you shouldn't make any general views about what the government thinks is a reason to bring a case or not.
Your Honor, if I may, I think that this does demonstrate the prejudice and the manifest injustice if the government is allowed to urge this narrower scheme theory on appeal, which was not presented to district court, to the jury, or to Judge Kennedy.
I don't understand how we stopped the trial so that your client suffered no injustice at all.
Your Honor, the manifest injustice is that had the government presented this narrower scheme theory below. We could have briefed an issue of first impression in the D.C. Circuit, which is under Wittig, Kavanaugh, no relation, and under Saylor.
It is briefed.
That's why we're talking about this. You have a very good argument, and we're trying to figure out whether it's right or not.
I think it is right, because this is a fundamental fairness here. A defendant prepares against a particular case, and Judge Kennedy took 6 weeks of his
now
time
back,
in the
now
jurors'
Now you're back
time.
To the other argument, that is, that it wasn't raised at the trial, right?
Yes.
Okay.
We'll just have to
look at those cases. I mean, if you're wrong about the cases, then... then there's no bar to this. Then you have your backup waiver argument that they didn't present it to Judge Kennedy, right?
Well, and actually, I would respectfully urge that Your Honors should ground your ruling, at least in part, on this smaller, narrower aspect of the case, which is that the government did not present it below.
By below, you mean to the district court
or to Judge Kennedy?
To Judge Kennedy.
Okay. Because... under the Wittig, the Kavanaugh and Saylor cases, what happens is that even under the government's theory, the reason that the jury hung was that it was not provided adequate instructions for how to deal with a narrower scheme theory.
You're not even supposed to ask about the reason the jury hung, I thought.
Well,
isn't that the point?
No, this is a distinct theory from Ash. The second part of Wittig, Kavanaugh and Saylor. Which is that regardless of whether there's been it could have been a case with all hung counts. If the government presented a single theory to the jury and for strategic reasons did not submit an alternate theory to the jury, and if the jury hung because it lacked adequate instructions for how to cope with that theory, if it should arrive at it, the government is responsible for a mistrial.
See, you keep going back and forth between your two waiver theories.
On the
narrower one, I thought you meant by the narrower one that the government did not present this theory to Judge Kennedy.
Yes.
Okay.
Let's
assume the government had, and Judge Kennedy had ruled in its favor. Okay. How would what we are talking about here, how would the briefing here look any different?
The way that this briefing would look different.
Except for the difference between it being raised in the red brief and the reply brief rather than the blue brief, right? Other than that.
Your Honor, there are a number of ways in which this might look different. One of them would be that the separate theory of waiver, Wittig, Kavanaugh, and Saylor, would be squarely before this court on full briefing. The second aspect would be that if the government thinks that it had that better trial that it could do the second time around, there might have been cause to order the transcripts of the second trial. I think that actually that's perhaps cured here because we now know, just looking at the record, that the government rested in the second trial without changing the indictment.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have anything else? No. Okay, thank you. Let's hear from the government.
May it please the court, Amanda Winchester on behalf of the United States. The jury's acquittals on three counts of mail fraud in this case do not collaterally stop the government from retrying appellant on the remaining counts of mail fraud, filing a false claim.
Why don't you start on the mail fraud? Why doesn't it stop the government from proceeding on the mail fraud counts?
Regarding the mail fraud counts, the jury's acquittals on counts 2, 3, and 5 did not necessarily decide that appellant had not engaged in any aspect of the alleged scheme.
You dropped the argument that you made below about furtherance, that these were merely procedural and therefore that's the reason the jury acquitted.
We enhanced on that argument.
Well, that argument is completely inconsistent with the jury instructions, right?
It would have been unclear to the jury. We argue under the jury instructions that were given.
Yes,
it would have been unclear to the jury under the instructions given.
Indeed, it would be inconsistent with the government's own argument to the jury, right? That is, that what was mailed and whether it was inferences, quote, won't be a big issue for you, right?
Correct. We don't mean to imply that these mailings could never objectively be determined to be in furtherance of a scheme to defraud. But under the instructions that were given, the judge instructed on other issues of criminal intent, including the general principles of good faith.
But not on the furtherance. So I just want to get on this. I would like to eliminate this from the rest of our discussion. And I don't want to browbeat you into that, but I don't really see how you can continue with that argument. The judge's instruction was, it is not necessary for the government to prove that the items mailed were false or fraudulent or contained any false or fraudulent statements. The government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the use of the mails furthered or advanced or carried out in some way the scheme or plan. And then, as Judge Tatel alluded, you told the jury there's no requirement that the items actually get mailed. I don't know if it was you. I don't mean to put it that way. So here I suggest this won't be a big issue for you, because all the government has to prove is that the things were mailed and that they were mailed for the purpose of advancing.
That's correct, Your Honor. The jury was instructed, however, that the government must prove that the mails were, in fact, used in some manner to further or advance or carry out the scheme to defraud or obtain money or property by false or fraudulent pretenses or admissions. And this left a jury potentially that was considering or had a reasonable doubt as to whether the government's larger scheme to defraud that was alleged was actually in existence and could have actually believed that there was a narrower scheme to defraud when considering those instructions in
Wouldn't
combination.
Is there any of the mailings that would have been in furtherance of a narrower scheme rather than a broader scheme, or a broader scheme rather than a narrower scheme? You certainly didn't make that argument, did you?
Well, that's right. But the argument is that considering the mailings on their face, the jury would not have been able to determine necessarily under the instructions given, because there were no fraudulent or misleading representations on the face of the acquitted mailings, whether or not those mailings were in furtherance of appellant's scheme.
What's your other argument?
As opposed to a legitimate scheme. We specifically focus on the good faith instruction, Your Honor, and that the jury didn't have to necessarily decide that there was no scheme to defraud in the case, because on the basis of the good faith instruction, the jury could have decided that on the face of those particular mailings, the appellant lacked.
I don't get that. The good faith instruction went to the entire scheme, and the entire scheme was charged from December through June. And the way it was charged in the indictment, the way it was charged to the jury, it said the judge said complete defense, I think. So the jury must have found, because it was the only thing presented, the jury must have found good faith. And if it found good faith, I don't see how any of the counts survive.
Well, there was nothing limiting the good faith instruction, Your Honor, to the entire scheme. And we argue that actually the jury would have been looking at the good faith instruction with regard to each particular mailing and each particular mail fraud count.
Why does that make sense under the instructions or under Schmuck, the case Schmuck? The mailings don't have to be fraudulent. They're just to help get the jurisdictional hook. What's relevant is the fraud. And the fraud alleged, the scheme in the indictment, is from December through June. It's a unitary scheme. And the way you said it, and not you again personally, but in rebuttal, this case is about whether he lied to the VCF about the nature and extent of his injuries, his physical limitations, and whether he deceived the VCF to try to get $331,000 that he didn't deserve. The whole case was, is he making it up? Is he making up his injuries or not? That was the whole case. And I looked through it all. And I don't see how it doesn't rise or fall together. Now, the reason this is a little unfair to you is because it seems that the jury misunderstood the instructions. So I get that. But we can't take account of that. So,
First of all, Your Honor, I would not agree that the entire case was tried in an all-or-nothing fashion in terms of there only being one unitary scheme to defraud. The government made a series of allegations regarding appellant's various fraudulent conduct.
Yes, various conduct that helped support the idea, as charged in the indictment, that there was a single scheme. It's a very simple, common sense question. We see it all the time. Is he making up his injuries to enhance his benefits under this compensation scheme? See it all the time in the pension area, what have you.
The government did argue, in fact.
And obviously there are going to be little pieces of that that you prove. Okay, he was lying here, he went to the doctor, he said he went to the doctor here, he didn't, and that's going to be over a period of time to support the idea of the scheme. But as charged, it was December through June. Single scheme, single question.
Well, the government did argue explicitly with regard to six and seven, counts six and seven, that the entire scheme did not have to be proved and that it was enough.
Isn't this the same thing in Yeager as the Fifth Circuit on remand from the Supreme Court? The insider trading count, I mean the fraud counts, went to the investors conference in January of 2000, the Enron investors counts, conference. And then on remand, the Fifth Circuit says, okay, the fraud is after that. So there's the same kind of temporal divide that you're pointing out here with counts six and seven. But the Fifth Circuit says, but as a logical matter, you couldn't have. The jury must have found that he didn't possess material inside information, and that applies to both, even though as a theoretical matter, you could dream up some scenario by which he later obtained that. Isn't that the same analysis here?
We'd argue that it's different in this case because the evidence with regards to the false claim counts, counts six and seven, was different and stronger.
Different and stronger? In what way?
That's correct. So regarding counts six and seven, even if the jury necessarily decided that there was no scheme to defraud involving counts one through five, the jury could nonetheless have decided that appellant made material representations at the May 13th, 2004 appeal hearing.
Right. That's all part of a scheme. Let me, if there's a scheme charge from December through June and the jury says no, can you come back and charge a May and June scheme, a subset scheme? Or are you arguing that it's not a subset?
I'm just arguing, Your Honor, that the scheme changed, and we explicitly argued that the scheme changed at the time of the
scheme at the hearing was a subset of the larger, at best, a subset of the larger scheme.
That's correct, but it wouldn't preclude acquittals as to the earlier portion of the scheme.
Let me give you a hypothetical to see if I understand the theory. Suppose there's a bank robbery that occurred on October 1st, okay? And the defendant says, mistaken identity, I was out of the country on a two-week trip from September 30th through the second week of October. Acquittal. That's the sole defense. And then the defendant's charged with a new bank robbery that occurred on October 2nd. Different bank robbery altogether, has nothing to do with the first bank robbery. Is there collateral estoppel in that case?
I don't know that there would be collateral estoppel.
Why not? The jury necessarily found he was out of the country as the defense, mistaken identity.
Oh, I see. And that was the only evidence that
yes.
was at issue,
right.
Which is what we're arguing here is different because there is new evidence and okay. the allegations exceed the original
mail. How much does it exceed, just so I get that clear? So if you're precluded on retrial from charging anything that was in any of the mail fraud counts, how much money is at stake in this case? They say about $1,000 to $10,000.
I don't have a precise figure, and we'd argue that it just doesn't matter in this case. The government alleged that there was a certain amount of theft of over $300,000, but as the jury was instructed, in order to prove theft in this case, the government only needed to prove a value over $1,000, and this precise value did not need to be proved. To prove the theft count, it wouldn't necessarily depend on a precise value having been
proved. Why didn't you charge multiple schemes or argue multiple schemes?
I don't know the charging decision, but it became clear under the evidence that the scheme was changing in form and that the jury could have, under the instructions, premised its guilt on counts six and seven.
One
on
good
that
answer
basis.
Is he didn't know Yeager was going to come out the way it did, I suppose.
So.
Can I just ask about this? I thought it was relatively typical that the government might charge a scheme over a long period, a single scheme, but still end up with a jury instruction that doesn't require that the scheme last the entire length sustain convictions when you only prove part of it. That is, you give the full notice. The purpose of the indictment is to give the full possible notice of the possible claims, but it can be narrowed at trial, or very few cases does the government prove the entire length of the scheme. Is that wrong?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that does happen.
An example of Judge Kavanaugh raised, imagine that you had an indictment which charges a scheme to commit bank robberies. And then, and that's the first, from January through March. And then you have counts which are different bank robberies, but the first part of which says these are all pursuant to the same scheme. The fact that there's an acquittal on one, where the guy was in London, it doesn't mean that that would preclude a conviction on another where the guy was in the bank.
That's correct. And the same scenario applies to this case. We argue where the evidence regarding count six, as I said before, was different and stronger.
Doesn't it depend on why they, in Judge Garland's hypothetical, it depends on why they acquitted. It depends on what the evidence was. It depends on what the defense was. Lisa Ash tells us we have to take a practical look at all the evidence. What was presented in a particular case, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer to that question.
That's likely correct as well, but in this case, it's clear that there was new and different evidence presented that applies to counts 6 and 7 that could sustain conviction. And specifically, if I could just point the court to some of that evidence, the government alleged that appellant had his employer submit a letter to the hearing officer purporting to document the hours appellant had taken off work to attend medical and particularly physical therapy appointments that appellant's medical records confirmed he never attended. And the government also alleged that appellant at that hearing submitted a spreadsheet inflating his salary, purporting to make a salary of $150,000.
So why didn't that? But that's all part of the mail fraud scheme too, right?
No, these are new claims.
No, but it's part. You could have been found guilty of mail fraud based on fraud that occurred any time with, as Judge Garland just pointed out, any time within the scope of the temporal scope of the scheme, right? The mailings don't have to be fraudulent. The mailings just have to be in furtherance of.
Correct.
So any fraud at the hearing that you're talking about, had it occurred, the jury would have said, you know what? He committed mail fraud. Committed fraud at the hearing. He lied at the hearing. Therefore, he's guilty of mail fraud counts. No.
No, the jury would not.
No, your answer has to be yes. But Yeager doesn't say could have. Yeager is not a case about what the jury could have decided. It's what the jury had to decide. Right.
Correct. It's about what was necessarily decided. In this case, when the conduct that we're talking about in counts 6 and 7 occurred after the acquittal and the mail fraud counts, the jury did not have to decide by virtue of those acquittals anything relating to the allegations.
Do you think the jury necessarily had to decide that the defendant acted in good faith with respect to a scheme that was alleged to have occurred from December through June?
No. The jury, first of all, we argue that at no point did the jury actually find that the defendant was actually acting in good faith.
I understand.
But
jump over that hurdle.
The good faith instructions, and let me get back to those that were provided by the court, were that good faith was a complete defense to all the charges, and it was the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
It's not only a complete defense, it was the only defense. That's what my problem in this case. The good faith was a complete defense and also was the only defense, and so it's all or nothing, right? And where am I wrong? I might be wrong on this, and there's certainly evidence. I agree with you. There's a little bit different evidence at the hearing, and ultimately that may save 6 and 7. I don't know. But I'm stuck on the complete defense and only defense.
We argue that, again, that this case was not tried in an all-or-nothing fashion, and we did have various allegations related to various specific fraudulent misrepresentations. But the appellant had and presented in his testimony explanations for many of those. For example, with the count three mail fraud count that was acquitted, that involved the mail records that were presented to advance the claim. And he, the appellant as a defense generally, to the submission of those mail records, indicated that he had given his attorney all of his medical records and that his attorney only submitted the records that his attorney believed were pertinent. He also indicated that there was no intent to defraud by virtue of the submission of those mail records because actually portions of the mail records disclosed his prior injury to his neck and disclosed an injury that occurred while he was playing basketball, so it also disclosed his physical activity. So there were various defenses alleged to the particular mailings
There's not a defense that the mailings didn't occur.
Correct.
And all that's needed is the mailings to have occurred.
Appellant's argument is...
You would have a good argument if the defense had said, A, I acted in good faith, and by the way, I never mailed those things. Then we wouldn't know. But I think under mail fraud law as it stands, so long as they were mailed, what you were just saying doesn't matter.
From the face of those mailings, though, because there were no fraudulent misrepresentations in those mailings on their face, a jury, under the instructions provided, could have had a reasonable doubt as to whether the defendant had the necessary criminal intent with respect to each of those mailings.
The jury was specifically instructed that didn't matter.
Under the in furtherance instruction, the jury was instructed that it need not find that the defendant intended...
But for each mail fraud count, there had to be intent to defraud.
Correct. That's what we argue under the instructions as a whole, including the good faith defense argument that was presented.
Okay. Thank you. I think Mr. Klepper's out of time, right? You can take 2 minutes if you'd like it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Your Honors, I would remind the court of the realism and rationality that's required in review of the record. And when you look at the point here from when it was read into the record, the VCF hearing transcript, yes, it did state that this wage was something that had not been presented earlier. But the most that you can really find in this trial are hints of a narrower scheme, or to use another phrase, emanations and penumbras. If you were to take them from facts and come together, the jury might have seen a narrower scheme. But when the government talked of inflation of the claim in its arguments, it was speaking of, at least potentially, if he did have an injury from those records that were shown in 9/11, because he did have records from September 21st, that, well, he was inflating above that, even if it was some small tweak. And the inflation went to the beginning. And that is the context.
Inflation about the nature of the injury. I think the government has a very difficult argument with respect to the injury as compared to what changed in May, which is economic compensation for whatever the injury was. That is a line that's considerably different than the line you're talking about here. And the government has a claim. This is an evidentiary claim. I don't know whether they win or lose in the end, whether it's presented, but that the letter that your client sends to his lawyer saying, look, now we're going to make a big push, now we're going to go for the economic compensation, that's different in kind. And the Jaeger, I've now looked at, with the miracle of Westlaw, the remand, which is totally opaque as far as I can see.
Well, it is.
Three paragraphs. It says that at the conference they must have decided that there was no insider information.
Your Honor, If you look at the 2008 Jaeger decision.
Yeah, footnote 18. If the jury found that Jaeger did not have insider information at the conference, it must also have found that he did not have insider information when he conducted his trades in the subsequent months.
Right.
So I don't know what that means to hear, but it's at least.
But what was there evidence?
It's interesting.
Was there evidence in that case that he got insider information later?
There does not appear to have been evidence in that case.
Right, and that's I'm not saying that's decisive, but yeah. it suggests that Jaeger is not going to decide this, even if we thought that the Fifth Circuit controlled us.
What I would say, Your Honor, is that count five, the mailing, was to request the hearing,
right.
And so if that was a if count five, which was acquitted, was not in furtherance, that's a pretty quick flip of the switch to say that count five was not part of that. He had no idea he was going to try to increase the value of his economic claim at the time of the count five mailing. That's part of the push that he's discussing with his lawyer. And that under the realism and rationality approach, I don't think that that was properly before the court. And in closing, I would just say that it's only for manifest necessity that we ever allow retrial of hung counts, ever. And I don't think that the government has shown that manifest necessity here.
Thank you. The case is submitted.